Welcome to this Friday edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. With me today, we're going to be talking to James Hoagland about Juno Pride Week. We're also going to be here about Only Fools Run at Midnight. Corey Stinnett will be here to highlight next week's workshop for parents and daughters on puberty. We're going to be getting a preview of Saturday's performance by Colleen O'Brien and Chris Lee, and also an Alaskan celebrity, cartoonist and filmmaker Chad Carpenter will be with us here to talk about his new film, Moose, which is going to be showing at the Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater. That's all coming up in just a little bit, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. An auction of Hopi and Acoma Pueblo ceremonial items took place in Paris this week. Some objects in the collection are from the early 20th century and fetched several thousand dollars each. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, it's the latest in a series of controversial sales that have included items sacred to Native Americans.
Hopi tribal members traveled to Paris this week to try to stop the auction. They say the sacred objects, known as Kachina Friends, are collectively owned by the tribe and can never leave the reservation. Any such auction equates to selling stolen property. The French have denied Native American nations of any legal standing, and so far the government agency responsible for the auctions has refused to stop them. Recently, Arizona's entire congressional delegation called on the FBI and the U.S. Justice Department to pressure the French government into halting the sales. Worldwide groups, including the Holocaust Art Restitution Project, have condemned the auctions, which are illegal in the U.S. according to federal law. Since 2013, there have been several such sales of Native American items in Paris. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A recent conference took place on the Wind River Reservation to explore how to save native languages of indigenous peoples across the globe. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards has more.
Linguist and keynote speaker Andrew Cowell from the University of Colorado says indigenous speakers came from all over the world to discuss new strategies for rescuing dying languages.
There are people coming in from Canada, as well as around the U.S. and internationally. There are people coming from New Zealand, Maori speakers, and also from Taiwan, for example. And they're sharing ideas, sharing thoughts about what works, what doesn't work.
Cowell co-authored a new collection of Arapaho songs and stories with native speakers Alonzo Moss and William C. Hare. The Arapaho language is now mainly spoken fluently only by elders 65 years and older. And C. Hare says the challenge now is to make it relevant to younger generations.
Without the language, it is impossible to really interpret our life ways. For our young students, you know, that don't have the language, they have a very low self-esteem and low concept of themselves. They don't know who they are.
C. Hare gives an example of the complexity of the Arapaho language and why it should be rescued from extinction. He says there's even one verb tense that's just for storytellers.
We have the present, we have the past, we have the future, and we have an additional one that no others have is what we call a narrative past. A narrative past, you know, it denotes that the speaker don't have first-hand knowledge of what he's speaking about, so he makes that known.
In its 22-year history, this is the first time the Stabilizing Indigenous Language Symposium has been held in Wyoming. Last year, it took place in Hawaii. Linguist Cowell says while the conference is geared towards Native speakers, he hopes the general public will recognize the value of Native languages as part of the American heritage. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
Flags on the Navajo Nation are at half staff for Navajo code talker Bahi Ketchum. Ketchum passed away earlier this week in Flagstaff, Arizona. He served with the Marines from 1944 to 1946. His son Marvin says his father received a whole slew of medals, including the Congressional Silver Medal for his service as a Navajo code talker. He says his father often talked of working for headquarters during World War II, transmitting and translating messages for generals, commanders, and top brass, and saw action on the battlefield. Ketchum was 96 years old at the time of his death. The National Park Service is holding a public meeting next week on the long-term management plan for Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site in Colorado. The plan was developed over a period of 10 years and included tribal input. In the 1800s, the U.S. Army attacked and killed many Cheyenne and Arapaho people at the site. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Supported by the National Indian Education Association, an inclusive Native organization representing Native students, educators, families, communities, and tribes. Membership registration available at niea.org.
The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
Programming is supported by Alaska Graphics, showcasing businesses and organizations through on-screen advertising at Gross Alaska Movie Theaters, now including animation, video, and optional audio. Information on advertising on the big screen at akonscreen.com.
Now, welcome back to a Juno Afternoon, where here, June 12th, is the kickoff of Gay Pride Week here in Juneau, Alaska, and I guess across the globe as well. James Hoagland is with us right now to talk about this. Welcome to the studio, James. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Andy.
Big week ahead of you. Lots going on.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. Yes. Happy Pride
happy
to you
Pride.
As well.
Yes.
And do you find yourself in the seat of organizing this year? Or you?
I sure did.
And so a big undertaking, right?
It is. It is. I am corralling the Pride Committee this year, and it's been an awesome experience.
That's cool. Yeah, it seems like all different people are getting involved and celebrating this week, and you've even got people coming from out of town, and you've got the kickoff. The kickoff's happening tonight.
Yep, we are kicking off more than a week of events. We've got something like 14 different events over the next 9 or 10 days. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous, but it's going to be a lot of fun. Anyway, we kick off tonight at the Hangar Ballroom at 7 o'clock. We're having a kickoff reception with the Juno Pride Chorus.
Who are awesome.
They are incredible.
Yeah, so
and
fun.
So we get a treat. Usually they only do one concert a year, but they're doing like a mini concert for us tonight. We've got Jesse Keel from the Juno Assembly there to read the Mayor's Proclamation, which names June as Pride Month here in Juno.
So is that the first time that's happened?
That is the second time.
Okay.
Last year was the first, and Jesse was really helpful in getting that passed through. And it's just sort of that extra stamp of approval.
That's
you know,
awesome.
Honoring this fantastic celebration.
It's such a kind of joyful week, right? I mean, a lot of what the week is about recognizing that there's been a real struggle for equality,
absolutely.
for having acceptance in society, but it's also this joyful celebration of the fact that it's getting closer and closer all the time.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't actually know where Pride came from as a concept, and so just to catch everyone up, 1969, New York City. There was a bar called Stonewall, and it was a gay bar, and it got constantly raided by the police. There was a lot of hostility at that time, as you can imagine, and finally the patrons fought back, and that turned into this huge riot, several day long, and every year on that anniversary, people come together all around the world to remember that struggle and celebrate the freedoms and the increasing equality and justice that we've come to experience
because of those
folks.
Yeah, one of the first times in America, at least, that the gay community really said, look, we're out, we are people. We want to celebrate the fact that we have a lifestyle that's our lifestyle, and we have
and
the exact same kind of life that everyone else has, except we happen to be gay.
Yep,
and,
exactly.
And then fought for that kind of right to be able to freely express that, which is seems like America.
Exactly.
So,
45 years later, it's a pretty different picture out there for in most places, at least in the U.S., and it certainly is a very different picture here in Juneau. And so we come together to celebrate the community, to honor that past and that struggle, and just have a great time together, all together.
It does seem like it's a fairly joyful time in the history of people who are gay in the world.
Yes.
I mean, I certainly see that. I have a daughter who's in her 20s, and it's so different for her, and there's so much more acceptance in her generation of people who are gay and that happening in high school, whereas in my generation, that seemed like torture for a lot of young people.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I'm sure it still is to this,
yeah.
You know, that's yeah. Part of what things like Gay Pride are trying to get across is, you know, that's just who you
for
are.
Sure.
And yeah,
well, you know,
yeah.
We still see that, like, looking at youth suicide rates, LGBT teens are at 4 times the risk as their heterosexual counterparts. And so we know there's still, you know, certainly a need for awareness and visibility and these kind of public celebrations and things like the mayor's proclamation. You know, that really matters to the kid at JDHS who's really struggling with their own identity and doesn't know where to look to for support.
Yeah.
You know, these things all really, really still matter.
Yeah.
And those of us who have been out a long time, you know, we get to not only party and have a good time, but also give back to the community.
So let's talk about some of the good times, some of the parties and fun stuff that's going to be happening this upcoming week.
Yes. So tomorrow night we have a huge party. This is the biggest thing we've ever done, and it's definitely the biggest thing Juno's ever seen. We have a drag queen from RuPaul's Drag Race, which is, you know, an international phenomenon at this point. And one of the queens named Detox is from L.A., and she's coming up, and she's putting on a huge show at Rockwell Ballroom.
Cool.
We've got entertainers from Seattle, Anchorage.
Now, what does that show look like? That's what, you know, what's the show? You know, kind of give a preview of what
it is going to be.
What is that?
It is.
Is it just kind of a review? Is it kind of
so everyone will do their own numbers, and there'll be a mix of lip syncing and dancing and live performance and comedians. And so it's sort of a variety show review. It'll be from 9 to 11, and doors open at 8. We've sold out of all of our VIP tickets, and that was the only way to reserve a seat. But we still do have some seats available, so get there early if you want.
All right,
if you want to get in on the action.
Cool. And then so that's tomorrow night. Then
yep.
What's happening the rest
of the
week?
We've got a film
then?
Series at the Gold Town, and that's actually 3 different dates over the course of next week. But we're showing films that are a little bit more meaningful. They're not just great films, but they bring up really meaningful conversations with other groups in the community. So, for example, the first film that we're showing is called Pride, and that talks about workers' rights and economic freedom and LGBT issues. So the Central Labor Council here in Juneau is partnering with us present that film. So, like, really interesting things like that are going to be happening at the Gold Town all week.
Okay. And then I know that just an aside, there's ice cream.
Yes. So
it's going to be ice cream.
One of our favorite local cafes is Copa, which I'm sure many of you know. And their incredible owner, Mark Wheeler, decided he wanted to take part in Pride as well. And so he came up with 2 homemade ice cream flavors to honor Pride Week. And they're called Rainbow Wedding Cake.
Okay.
And Harvey Milk Chocolate.
Which I think is awesome.
So those will be available this afternoon. They're hardening up as we speak.
Oh, very good. Okay. In the deep freeze.
Exactly. And so you can go over to Copa and celebrate Pride and get some ice cream, which just sounds awesome
to
me.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to do it. Any other big highlights happening in the
week
coming
up? Yeah, so we end
the
week on Solstice with a huge picnic at Sandy Beach. It is always our biggest event during Pride, and it's kind of that annual thing that everybody comes out to. You see all your old friends, you meet new people in town. We'll be providing food, and you can bring a side if you want to, but come on out. It's family friendly. We've got activities for the kids.
Great.
Face painting, arts and crafts, all that good stuff.
It's a big beach party. Beach party fair.
And the weather should be awesome.
Yes.
It looks great. So I think we're going to be having a lot of outdoor fun.
Look at the blob is going to come back and protect our weather. Pacific blog. Blob. So, James, any other highlights you want to mention? Obviously, tons of activity happening. Starts kind of kick off tonight.
Yep.
Hangar Ballroom.
So, all of our events are free.
Okay.
And all except 2 of them are all ages. So we really worked hard to get those 2 things accomplished, and we really appreciate all the sponsors, donors, contributors. There's been so many hands putting this week together that, you know, really wouldn't have been possible.
Just
otherwise.
Kind of that dream of it becoming more and more a big community-wide event is just continuing to happen.
Months and months long.
Yes, yes.
Maybe we'll take December off.
Right, December off. You'll just be events, events, events.
Right.
James Hoagland, thanks so much. That's Juno Pride Week.
Thank you.
It's starting tonight as the big kickoff is happening at the Hangar Ballroom. That starts what time?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, and see everyone there. Sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks, James.
Yes. Thanks.
Just entered the studio, Jason Showman and Tristan Knutson Lombardo are here. Thanks you guys for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Yeah. So
I nailed the name.
I nailed it. I nailed the name. I always do. What? What are you talking about?
You got one of them. Anyway.
Only Fools Run at Midnight coming up tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night.
It's wild. It's right upon us. I'm excited. I get to MC it, so thanks you guys for getting me involved in it. And
I mean, you're the greatest MC we've ever had.
Well, there you are. Now you go on, would you? But it's a fun event, and this year's something a little transition's happening here. SAIL is transitioning kind of the running of the event over to K2. So tell us a little bit about the history, and then. You're switching it over.
Well, a lot of people, you know, this is the 31st annual event, so
amazing.
It's a long-running event, no pun intended. It used to be a fundraiser for MDA years ago. The Volunteer Firefighter Department put it on. SAIL took it over about 13 years ago, I think. And this year we decided that, you know, it's run its course with us, and we figured that public media, K2, was a great partner and a group to pass it on to. So we're excited. We're transitioning, moving it on to the kind of the next chapter. And
yeah.
I think you all are a great place for it to be.
And Justin, how's it been organizing it?
It's been great. Yeah. Working with SAIL has been a pleasure. Working with Tristan has been great. And we're really excited to be, I guess, in the driver's seat next year on this event and sharing the responsibilities this year. It's a fantastic community event.
Yeah.
I'm really excited.
So what are some of the big challenges on the course? What's the course, first of all? Is it the same course as always?
The same course we've had for quite a while, yeah. So you're going to start on right in front of Bullwinkle's, everybody's favorite pizza parlor.
Yes, right. Carbo loading.
That's right. Carbo load before. And you're going to take off and run down Willoughby as it turns into Glacier Highway. The one-mile runners will turn around right after the federal building and then come straight back. But then the 5K runners go up through the highlands and get a little hill workout, then head out towards Aware on Glacier Highway and turn around and come straight back on the main drag.
And then it's always fun to see, like, especially the younger kids will often run the 1 mile and they'll just burn it, right?
Yeah.
They'll just burn it down.
Oh, yeah, totally.
and then it's fun. It's such a fun mixture because there's some people who are really running it. They want to run it race. And then there's a lot of people, of course, who do the costumes and all that stuff. So there's fun stuff around the costumes, right? That's going to be
that's a huge piece of the event. And there will be prizes and costumes will be judged. A very esteemed panel of judges this year. We have Jeremy Shea from here at K2, Jeff Brown, a name you all know and love.
He knows fools when he sees them. That Jeff Brown does. Oh, yeah.
And then we have Kate Burkhart. She's a board member at SAIL, okay, yeah, but she's also a DJ here at KRNN.
Sure.
So there's a foot in both worlds.
That's cool. All right. Yeah.
And we have great prizes from, just to name a few, from Alaska Travel Adventures, Wings, Nugget Alaskan Outfitter, Heritage. The list goes on. A ton of great sponsors again this year.
And the categories are fun because you can do individual stuff or you can go sometimes couples, sometimes groups, and sometimes, of course, the dreaded centipede.
The dreaded centipede.
Yes, which is the linked up multiple runners that can go dozens deep, right? I mean, you know.
We have a group sign up yesterday. It's like 25 people, so I think maybe 30.
They're calling themselves the amoeba.
Yeah. Right?
Just spread out. So we'll see what they come up with. It's always fun, but I always want to encourage people to make sure they come in and get judged and then come back in after the race to make sure who won and that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes we hear later, oh, there was this great costume, but they never came in to get judged at Centennial, so we never saw it, you know what I mean? We'd
right.
just go
I mean,
to the race
don't
course.
Don't assume that you're not going to get a prize. Assume you are going to
yeah,
get a prize
right.
and show up.
We got
so.
Lots of prizes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right,
there's good odds here.
Yeah, there are good odds. You put the effort in. And,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's hard. I know everyone gets tired. They just ran a 5K, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning. But,
right.
you know, get your prize,
it's
go home,
fun.
And then go flight scene next week.
Yeah,
so.
That's right. That's right. It's a fun time. So if people want to get involved and want to run, how do they do it?
Come to Centennial Hall. Pre-registration closed yesterday, but race day registration opens at 10:30 p.m. tomorrow. So
okay.
Just come to Centennial Hall. We'll have tons of volunteers there directing traffic, helping you out. We still have T-shirts available.
Yeah.
So there's
Those
good incentive
awesome.
To get there early.
Yeah, it's always good to have a full T-shirt. I got a few of them. I never ran the race. I just get them because I emceed it.
There you go.
Seems like a cheat.
Well, I don't know. We need volunteers.
Yeah, that's true.
It's probably a lot easier than
I guess I'm helping. I guess I'm helping. I feel all right. All right. Well, Tristan and Justin, good luck with the Only Fools Run at Midnight. It's happening tomorrow night. 10:30 is when the doors open. If you haven't yet registered, you can go and register. And there's even some T-shirts still available. So go check it out. Only Fools Run at Midnight. Be a fool.
Be a
run
fool.
At midnight. Come on. All right, you guys. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
Well, joining us next in the studio is Colleen O'Brien and Chris Lee. They're going to be putting on a concert at McPheeters Hall tomorrow night at 8 p.m. And it's going to be Where Words and Music Meet, both cello, vibes, and voice. Welcome to you both. Welcome to the studio. Welcome to Juno.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have you been here before?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We loved Juno.
Great.
Yeah.
And you've performed here before? Or?
Yes, both of us. Uh-huh.
Very nice. Uh-huh. Well, tell me a little bit about what people can sort of expect when they go to this concert tomorrow night at McPheeters Hall. What separates it from just sort of a regular cello
different.
Type thing?
Very different. So we've been on the road since last August.
We left Colorado last August, and we've been primarily performing in libraries throughout the West.
Okay.
Doing this program of poetry that's set to music and sung. We do everything from Shakespeare sonnets to Jack Kerouac, Robert Frost. So we're presenting this concert tomorrow, where we'll do two sets. But the first set will be the poetry set to music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a visual element. We have show the poems on a screen with images so people can see the poems as we're performing them. And we'll do that the first set, and the second set we'll be doing kind of a variety of just more of our other concert music.
Oh, okay. Which,
yeah.
Well, Colleen,
what was it that drew you to the idea of this really presenting poetry and then mixed with music instead of, you know, typically it's musical lyrics that are that kind of thing?
Which we've done all of it before, but this is special in that the poems define the composition. You know, so the rhythm of the phrases will help define how the composition is actually written. And the compositions are so beautiful. So Chris writes some of the pieces. We have a composer friend, wonderful saxophone player from Boulder, Colorado, Mark Miller, who we're going to present maybe three or four of his poems that are beautiful. He loves the Shakespeare sonnets.
His compositions, not his poems.
I mean his compositions, right, set to poetry.
Yeah, because Shakespeare's already written those.
Let's
make it clear.
That's right.
Yeah, that'd be a complete ripoff.
Thank you. So it's wonderful just singing these kinds of words, because they're so, they feel good in the mouth. They I think, you know, they were meant to be spoken.
Yeah,
right. So singing them is even better.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's really.
They are, they're lyrical, even spoken, they're lyrical.
Right.
Let's listen to a little here. Yeah. You guys can, we'll listen here, you can explain a little bit after we listen to just one cut. We're going to play this first cut off of the CD that you brought, and maybe give people an idea of what we're talking about here, and then we can come back in.
Yeah.
So that's, number one, that's beautiful. So thank you for letting us listen to that. And just explain a little bit about how, so the poetry came first.
Yeah, so that famous Robert Frost poem. And it's not a new concept. I mean, it's, especially in classical music, it's been done a lot. You know, composers would take a poem and set music to it, but it's usually done in a more classical, you know, and with more of an operatic singing style.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I guess probably about, a long time ago, 30 years ago, we heard Steve Swallow, who's a famous jazz bassist, did an album project of poems of Robert Creeley set to music. And so this was kind of the first time we had heard it done in more of a jazz setting. So somebody taking the poems and writing music to them. And that inspired us to, you know, to do that. And then I've composed many, and we've also sought out other people who've done similar things. Fred Hirsch, a famous pianist, has done a Walt Whitman CD. We do one of his pieces. This one is by Jacob Collier, who's a young British musician.
What are some of the challenges? Like, to me, it would be a challenge to take, especially something that's so well known and loved and internalized by so many people, a famous, beautiful poem. And then you're really, in a different way, sort of dictating how someone's going to hear that. Is that, you know what I mean?
It's true. Yeah. And, you know, we're astonished that people love it so much because they just whether people are more musically minded or they're into poetry, they say it's the first time they've ever thought of it that way, that it lifts the words off the page. They see it in a new way. We kind of still are just kind of pinching ourselves because we're just so surprised by the response.
Yeah, right.
And there's such diversity from one piece to the next. It's very diverse, you know, so it's what you hear there is going to be totally different from all the other pieces we do there. And that's the other thing people will say is that they can't really quite believe the diversity of music.
Is there improvisation that's happening on your part from a musical standpoint?
Yeah, so most of the pieces have some improvisational sections in them. So for us, it makes them more interesting because it's not, as opposed to classical music where it would be, you would play it exactly the same way every time. So this way, you know, the composition and the words are the same way every time, but there's a little more.
Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's still. There's still room for for improvisation and changing things up, and that's what keeps that's what we love to do. So.
Well, it sounds fascinating and sounds beautiful. Thanks so much for letting us hear a little sample of it for coming in. This is all happening tomorrow night. It's Saturday night, 8 p.m. at McPheeters Hall over at the Holy Trinity Church. And it is a beautiful space. You know, thing that the phoenix that rose from the ashes of that great center having burned down a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. They rebuilt, and now it's a beautiful center. You'll love it. I think you'll love playing there. It's got
fantastic.
Great acoustics.
Great.
And
we're looking forward to it.
Yeah. It'll be really good.
This will be for donation. And it will be split to help us, you know, continue with our program and travels and also to the church, to Holy Trinity Church. So they will benefit.
Great.
Also.
All right. Colleen O'Brien and Chris Lee, thanks so much for coming in and have a great time tomorrow night. And
all right.
Thanks for bringing in some Colorado weather into Juneau.
It's sunny.
There you go. That's wonderful. All right. Here's Garrison Keillor with Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 12th of June, 2015. It's the birthday of the woman who wrote Heidi, Johanna Spyri, born in the village of Herzl, Switzerland, in 1827. It's the birthday of Juna Barnes, born near Cornwall on Hudson, New York, 1892, went off to live in Paris, where she wrote the experimental novel Nightwood, and then spent the last 42 years of her life as a recluse in New York City. And it's the birthday of the young woman who wrote, "It's really a wonder that I haven't dropped all my ideals because they seem so absurd and impossible to carry out. Yet I keep them because, in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death." The words of Anne Frank, who was born on this day in 1929 in Frankfurt, Germany. She was 4 years old when the Nazis won the local elections in Frankfurt, and soon thereafter her father, Otto, moved the family to Amsterdam. Four of more than 300,000 other Jews who fled Germany in those years. In Amsterdam, her father sold fruit pectin, herbs, and spices, and after the Nazis invaded the Netherlands, and after Anne's older sister Margot had gotten notice to report to a German work camp, the Frank family walked in the rain to the father's warehouse and went up the stairs to a set of rooms in the attic that Anne would come to call the secret annex. Within weeks, they were joined by four other people, and for 2 years, eight people shared 500 square feet with one toilet that they could not flush during the day. Anne had gotten a red and white checkered cloth diary for her 13th birthday, and in that diary, she wrote, "When I write, I can shake all of my cares, my sorrow disappears, my spirits are revived, but will I ever be able to write something truly great, will I ever become a journalist or a writer?" The English translation of the diary, entitled Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, was published in 1952. it has sold tens of millions of copies. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston. It is raining on the house of Anne Frank. It is raining on the house of Anne Frank and on the tourists herded together under the shadow of their umbrellas, on the perfectly silent tourists who would rather be somewhere else but who wait here on stairs so steep they must rise to some occasion high in the empty loft, in the quaint toilet, in the skeleton of a kitchen, or on the map, each of its arrows a barb of wire, with all the dates, the expulsions, the forbidding shapes of continents. And across Amsterdam, it is raining on the Van Gogh Museum, where we will hurry next to see how someone else could find the pure center of light within the dark circle of his demons. A poem by Linda Paston, It Is Raining on the House of Anne Frank, from Carnival Evening, published by W.W. Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by LegalZoom, providing legal solutions for business owners, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The 4th of July is always a fun time in Juneau, but this year will be extra special with the arrival of the new old-time Chautauqua. Made up of 55 talented artists, musicians, and vaudeville performers, including the Flying Karamazov Brothers, the new old-time Chautauqua will infuse the festivities with several opportunities for fun, including a community potluck, a chalk drawing contest, an afternoon of workshops, and of course their vaudeville show on the 3rd. The full event schedule and vaudeville show tickets are at k2.org.
And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon, where the forecast for the rest of the day is for mostly cloudy skies, but then getting light and variable winds and some highs around 56 degrees and mostly cloudy for tonight as well. On the phone with us now is Corey Stinnett, who's going to be conducting a workshop called Growing Up, all about puberty, parent-daughter workshop. Thanks so much for getting us on the phone here, Corey. How are you?
Yeah. I'm great, Andy. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, no problem. And Corey, tell me just a little bit about what the kind of main idea behind the workshop is.
Absolutely. So these workshops are really to support parents and 10 to 12-year-old kids coming together and opening the lines of communication about puberty, about sexuality, about some of the physical and emotional changes that kids are going through at this time in their lives. And we really offer up these workshops as a way to support parents in feeling more confident in talking to their kids about these topics, and also in helping kids really realize that this is a very normal process that everyone goes through. And these workshops do a really good job of creating a group so that it is normalized to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I remember with my daughter having the talk, you know, and it would have been great to get a little coaching on what to say.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's not just the talk anymore, right? This is like, we hope this is the beginning of many talks, because we know that's what's going to help us all get through adolescence, or support kids getting through puberty and adolescence is lots of talks.
Well, that's actually so true, isn't it? I mean, that's a really important part of it, isn't it? It's like continuing to have a dialogue and a discussion, and it's just one of the many topics that you talk about. And if it's more normalized, then there's less mystery about it. There's more information, and there's more opportunity to make good decisions.
Absolutely, absolutely. Helping them make healthy decisions and you know, really being respectful to our kids, and so that they have an idea of what's coming their way, what are some of these changes that are going to happen, and it can help them feel a little bit more at ease to have that information, and help them be healthier.
So at these workshops, is it parents and their daughters coming together to the workshops? Is it how does it go? How does it work?
Yeah, this one coming up on Monday, June 15th, is for parents or guardians and their daughters. Again, kind of 10 to 12 year old range is where we're looking at for the kids, and parents come and we do a variety of activities. We watch a short video. Some of the activities are done as a large group. In some groups, kind of parents go and have a discussion while kids are having a discussion and processing through some of the information. We come back together. Everyone gets a chance to ask anonymous questions. And Andy, it starts off pretty awkward. I mean,
right.
we're just gonna own that. It's
sure.
To be expected. You know, a lot of kids aren't like, hey, parent, take me to a puberty workshop.
Right.
But parents know this is important. So it starts off a little awkward, and it's really amazing to watch how the group transforms and how kids are they want to know what's happening to them before it happens, you know?
Yeah, and I can imagine there's awkwardness on both sides of the
sure.
table, yeah.
Sure, and we work through that in a way that, you know, really supports both the parents and kids in getting a little more comfortable with these topics.
So tell me a little bit about the specifics. How can people find out more or get involved and make sure that they're getting to this workshop, especially if they have a daughter who's between 10 and 12 years old?
Excellent. Yeah, well, the best way is going to be to give me a call. My phone number is 209-7051. Again, that's 209-7051. I also have an email. It's very long, so I suggest we just go with the phone number.
Okay.
And folks can give me a call, and I'll respond. And we do ask that people register because there's a limited amount of space that we have, and we like to keep these groups relatively small, like about 10 families max. And that's just because that small group makes our workshop work a little better. So that's it, really.
Yeah.
Giving me a call at this point. And it's going to be this coming Monday, June 15th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m., and it'll be held here at the Planned Parenthood Health Center at 3231 Glacier Highway.
And you guys have all kinds of, like, educational tools and things like that there that just help the conversation go along, help parents and daughters kind of, you know, be able to bring things up in a comfortable way as this discussion continues to happen.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. All of these activities are really meant to stimulate conversation, to help clarify family values, whatever those may be, to establish expectations, and really provide some accurate information about the physical and emotional changes of puberty.
All right, Corey Stinnett, thanks so much. It's Growing Up, All About Puberty. It's a parent-daughter workshop. It's happening Monday at 5:30, goes to 8 o'clock, and if you want more information, you can contact Corey at 209-7051. Corey, thanks so much for calling in today. Really appreciate it.
All righty. Thanks a lot, Andy.
All right. Coming up next is Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. This rollicking song belongs to a black-headed grosbeak. Like most birds, the male grosbeak begins singing in earnest a few days after reaching his traditional nesting grounds in spring. And like most birds, he sings frequently when trying to attract a mate. He'll sing a bit less while he and his mate incubate eggs, but pick up the pace again after the young hatch. By late summer, his singing will cease. Ever wonder how much a bird sings in one day? Some patient observers have shown that a typical songbird belts out its song between 1,000 and 2,500 times per day. Even though most bird songs last only a few seconds, that's a lot of warbling. On nights with a full moon, male sage thrashers have been known to proclaim their long-winded songs all night. But the North American record holder may well be the red-eyed vireo. One such vireo delivered its short song over 22,000 times in 10 hours. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Welcome to Juno Afternoon, and back in the studio with me now, Pat Race and Chad Carpenter. Chad, thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for letting me in the door.
So exciting. Alaskan celebrity right here. cartoonist extraordinaire. You might know him best as the cartoonist of Tundra. So many great funny
Alaskan
moments.
Alaskan cartoon laureate, I believe.
Cartoon laureate.
True. I forgot about that part.
Well, you joined Jeff Brown as the balloon laureate of Alaska.
There we go. Balloon and, animal laureate.
A lot of prestige in this building.
There is. Oh, yeah, man. It's a power-packed building. A lot of celebrity power. Well, Chad, thanks so much. And you're in town actually to promote a film. Tell me about Moose.
It's a film we filmed last summer. It's all an independent film, done 99% volunteer, 99% Alaskan. Everybody involved in it, with the exception of a couple of people who are all from here in Alaska. And it's an independent film the basic plot is there's a couple of park rangers in the town of Gangreen Gulch, Alaska. And with a young...
The beautiful town of Gangreen Gulch.
It doesn't get any prettier than that. And a young coroner's assistant, who's a very pretty young lady, who's actually smarter than the other two, they start noticing there's some moose tramplings going around the town, and they're not normal. They seem to be a little more malicious. And it turns out it's not a normal moose. It's a two-legged moose, half man, half moose, a moosator.
Moose Man, the dreaded Moosator.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's a comedy.
Okay.
So people know, right?
Absolutely.
Do not take that too
Sounds
seriously.
Terrifying.
Is this kind of the first? Have you shown it? Has it been showing around the world or around Alaska? Or?
Surprisingly, yeah, it's been in a lot of places. We've shown it in where I'm from, Wasilla. It had a 2-week run there, and it turned into a 6-week run because people have nothing else to do, evidently, and they just kept going to it.
The most negative way to look at it.
They came like around there throwing toasts and rice.
We're hoping to get to that point, yeah. But it also is just running. We signed a deal with Regal Cinemas, which is a big surprise. But we ran it in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Kenai in their theaters, and they're going to run it also in Spokane, Seattle, even in L.A. and Denver, which is a huge shock.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Is there thoughts of taking it to festivals and things like that? Or
it's happening so fast that we don't even know what we're doing. we didn't know what we were doing when we started.
Full disclosure. Here.
Yeah, and so we haven't had time to even go, what do we do? Because it was supposed to just go straight to DVD. But when it started running in Wasilla at the theater there, which is also part of a chain, Coming Attractions Theaters, and they're going to run it in about 10 of their theaters too, in the lower 48. But when that happened, evidently other theaters heard about it and just started getting picked up more and more places. And now it's kind of developed a life of its own that we have no control over. So.
And your role in it, well, you wrote it?
My brother and I wrote it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And is that it? Or there's another director, there's other producers and stuff?
Yep.
Or do you have other roles in it? Or
I am the writer and producer.
Okay.
And I'm also a caterer. Exactly. that was my favorite title.
Very nice.
To make sure everybody got their hamburgers. Everybody wore many hats in this. It's like I said, it's an independent film.
Yeah.
So everybody had to do a lot of different jobs.
As the writer, when you and your brother were writing it, did it turn out the way you were thinking? When you write something, you have this visual idea in your head, and then mm-hmm. as a cartoonist, you get to dictate what that visual idea is going to really look like. But now having someone else, kind of a director and other people, and people acting and stuff like that, and how does that, tell me about how that works.
Yeah, it's a whole other process from cartooning. And this, the old saying is, well, I didn't hear it until I got involved in this, but I'm sure anybody in the business knows that you write one movie, you film another movie, and you edit another movie. And that's exactly what it was. What my brother and I wrote was a lot different from what we ended up filming, because you have limitations sometimes that we're supposed
to
have
a helicopter shot.
Exactly. This huge explosion and all the zombies and the dragons and all that. Well, we can't afford that, so let's just use this dog. It's that kind of thing. But then it also goes the other way, too, where you were given these opportunities that you never knew you'd have, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, my God, we're able to do something much bigger and grander than we thought because of either the venue we're given or the weather turns out incredible or... You name it. So it's a trade-off. And then, of course, when you're done with all the filming and you do the rough cut and all of a sudden you have this 3-hour movie, then that's where it gets really hard and you got to start popping things out of there. And so you have to sacrifice things that you really wanted in there, but it just can't be done because maybe it doesn't help the plot progress, even if it's funny.
Yeah.
Because you got to get it down.
That's got to be the hardest.
Yeah.
Give up something that's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And say, well, it's really funny. It's like this the old thing. The outtakes in a DVD often are so hilarious. You're like, well, why didn't they have that in the movie? And it's like, well, it would have been a 2.5-hour, 3-hour movie if you left it in. So
yeah, and it's an hour and 53 minutes right now. So
that's good.
Yeah, well, yeah, 8 minutes.
You want 2 hours out of a movie. I hate when movies are an hour and a half. You're not getting your money's worth.
Well, you'll get your money's worth out of this one.
Andy only orders large popcorn.
That's right. Well, I'm only half through my popcorn, man. So, were there parts of it that you, when you wrote it, that just turned out more awesome than you could ever have imagined?
Yeah. No, there were definitely parts. There were scenes.
Can you mention a few of the scenes?
No, because I'm making it all up, actually. It was all worse.
Well, I have a second question about that.
There were scenes that just turned out a lot better and funnier. Or, again, it was one of those things where you're on the set. And you start doing, you're filming, and then someone goes, hey, what if we do this? And then all of a sudden it's like, I never thought of that. And things get better from there.
That collaborative creative process. Yeah. That's what you hope for,
exactly.
Right, and that kind of thing.
So there's a lot of that where if you looked at the original script. In fact, I haven't read the original script in a long time. If I did, I'd probably go, oh, my goodness, what came out was so much better.
Right.
Or, every now and then you're, again, limited sometimes.
Sure, yeah. Have you ever written a script before? Have you ever, been produced and played out? Or
No, the first script I did, my brother again, and I did that, it was written before this one, of course, but it's the story would be a much bigger budget, and so we weren't able to do it. And so we thought, okay, if we're going to do one, we need to use what we have, which is Alaska. We have Alaska. We have great scenery. We have talented actors here. We have all this wonderful stuff. Let's use what we have.
Was that always part of your idea, that you wanted to write something that you then produced in Alaska? I mean, a lot of people want to write stuff and then, okay, let's go sell this. Let's go around Hollywood and see if we can get meetings.
I wanted to keep it very Alaskan, and my goal was this was just for Alaska. Now, all this other stuff that's been happening is just bonus, but that was my goal, was just, okay, let's just do this for Alaska, and that's how we want to do the next one, too. It's all going to be very Alaskan. If it works elsewhere, great. If not, it's still going to be fun, and hopefully we'll still make enough money to make another one. So that's how we're looking at it.
Is the next one already written or being written, or you're working on it?
We have three different ideas that are bouncing around, and they're very different. Each one is very different from each other.
Yeah.
It's also
polar bear atar.
Polar bear atar.
Squirrel atar.
Squirrel atar.
Yeah.
That's
what I want to say.
Yeah. We're looking for something that's going to be similar to what we did enough to retain the Alaskan-y personality of it, but different enough to where it's not just another creature movie.
Okay, so what was it like the first time you watched it with an audience?
Scary, really
excruciating.
Scary.
I can imagine it just would be almost not even fun because it's just so.
It was tense. It was hard to enjoy it. But the good thing was the first time I saw it with an audience, it was at the Valley Cinema, and it was a packed audience. But the reason, we felt good that it was going to be packed because it was most of our cast and crew and all their families.
Right.
So it was a pretty friendly audience. And so that one wasn't a true reading of what it was going to be like. But it was still very nerve-wracking because, you don't know what people are going to think. It was the next night when the first public opening premiere happened that we were all just sitting there very, very nervous about it. And it went off. Obviously, it went off good because they kept it for 6 weeks. But that was not easy. And audiences are different everywhere.
Right.
I don't mean that like we can have two showings in a town and you get one audience that they love it, and the next audience doesn't react quite the way you thought they would.
Sure.
So it all depends.
And then the old kind of, it's maybe a cliche, but the old thing of they react totally different to certain scenes, or they laugh where you didn't intend a laugh to happen and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one scene in this movie in particular that that we've been trying to figure out how can we fix that, because no matter how we fix it, and then every time we go to another theater, we have an opportunity to kind of tweak it a little bit
more.
And most scenes go over really well. Like I said, we've been really thrilled with the response. But there is one scene that's nagging at us, and we're trying to figure out how, and we can't cut it out because it's a bit of a plot point.
Right.
Yeah. So
it just feels like it's falling a little flat or something. Or it's just there's a joke that people aren't getting
goes flat.
Or something.
Yeah. Right. I don't think they think it's funny as I did. But just
keep it in for you. That's your private little part of the movie.
That's what it needs. That is actually what it needs. Maybe we'll do that. Actually, hopefully there'll be a drum set at the theater tonight.
All you need is a good sound effect, man. That'll fix all that.
I can give you a little plot spoiler here. It's the scene with the sausage.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
It's like a winner to me. I don't know.
So if anybody out there is listening and they're going to go see the movie,
gold, man.
Please
scene
laugh
of the sausage.
At that scene. Get the crowd going.
So Pat, tell me about bringing this movie in. What prompted it, and how'd you find out about it, and all that?
Well, we've been excited about the movie for a long time. Like you funded it through Kickstarter. So we knew about it back then, and we've seen trailers and test footage and photos as it's come along, and I was really excited to hear that Costa was bringing it to the Gold Town, and so we're gonna have him down there at the Gold Town tonight for two shows with some Q&A, and then tomorrow as well at the matinee show, and then we'll do a little book signing over at the gallery at 2:00 tomorrow if people have Tundra books in their house. They should pull them off the shelf and bring them down, or we'll have plenty down there to pick up.
Yeah, it's surprising to me actually when I think about it that you didn't want to do a cartoon movie. Essentially,
it's too much work.
Is that right?
Animation. I think back and attest to that. It's an hour and a half of animation. I'd be dead. There's just no way it could be done. Yeah. No way.
Don't they kind of farm it out? I mean, isn't that how it's done? Like, you do the certain frames, then you send it to whatever.
To Korea.
Kind of goes, I don't know.
And
I
mean, it's expensive.
Yeah. Is that right?
There's a great book about that called Pyongyang, and it's about the North Korean animation industry. And it's this French guy that did a journal of his trip there to work and he worked in North Korea on these animated films that, you know, they get kind of the key frames the artists send in. And
they just fill in.
Trip.
Yeah, they fill in the rest.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Kind of interesting. Work.
I'm glad he went this way. I think it's going to be a fun film to see, and it got a lot more people involved than an animated film would have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I can just, but you know, obviously you're so tied to that cartoon and been doing it for so many years, and you know those characters, or maybe you would want to do other characters.
It's nice to do something different.
Yeah. I can imagine.
This has been really fun. It's been a nice little distraction from drawing Tundra for 24 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next up with Tundra? Anything going on there? Are there books or are there compilations or
always,
things like that?
Always new books coming out.
Yeah.
Calendars, anything I can make a buck on, it's all coming out. We're working on that.
I think it's important to note the scale and scope of what you've created there. I mean,
it is amazing.
How many newspapers are you in and how long have you been doing it?
I've been doing it 24 years and we're in 650 papers.
650 newspapers?
That's not that many.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's amazing there's that many left, actually.
Yeah. Are you in one? Are you in King Syndicate? Are you in one of those?
They have the rights to Tundra overseas.
Okay.
Yeah, but I have one marketing guy. His name's Bill, and he's the Bill Syndicate. He has gotten me in all these papers by himself.
Wow.
Just over the last 8 years.
Amazing.
Up until 8 years ago, I was in 5 papers.
Wow, amazing.
And, he's greedy, so he's very motivated.
It seems like there's some different, you know, things have been happening in the comics world and, of course, print newspapers or all that stuff. There's, all kinds. It's a different world now.
Definitely changing.
Yeah, but it's incredible that over the last 8 years, everyone else has been dying off, and he stepped up from 5 papers to 600.
Incredible.
That's unheard of.
Kind of surprise. Yeah.
Well, it's success. It's well-deserved. Chad Carpenter, thanks so much for coming in. This is Moose. The movie, it's happening tonight at 7:00 and at 9:30 at the Gold Town Nickelodeon, and then there's a matinee that's happening tomorrow at 4:00. Are there tickets still all available for all the shows? Or?
Yeah, I believe so. You might want to show up a little bit early, especially if you want to meet Chad and hang out or get something signed. We'll have books both at the theater and at the Alaska Robotics Gallery, and there's a signing tomorrow at 2:00 at the Alaska Robotics Gallery.
All right, sounds
and
great.
If someone wants to see the trailers, they can go see moosethemovie.com, and it'll give them a good taste of what the movie's about.
Oh, all right, good tip, moosethemovie.com.
Yes,
or all just come and check it out, because that's the best way to see a
that's
film.
True.
It's like, I have no idea what this is.
The co-writers of the film is here, and it's going to be awesome.
It's
so
gonna be
thanks
great.
So much for coming to town
absolutely.
To do
Thank
this.
You.
And it was great to meet you.
Thank you.
All right, Chad Carpenter, once again, it's happening tonight, 7 and 9:30. That's Moose the Movie down at the Gold Town Nickelodeon, and tomorrow matinee at 4. Pat, thanks for coming in as well.
Thank you.
That's it for Juno Afternoon for today. Have a great weekend, everyone.
You say you want to start something new, and it's breaking my heart.
Whatever the deal is with other countries, we want a better deal for America's workers.
As for the deal that President Obama wants, the House of Representatives says no.
For Friday, June 12th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The House blocked the president's authority to negotiate trade pacts today.
We'll hear from columnists E.J. Dionne and David Brooks about that and other matters.
Also, an appeals court deals a blow to the military commissions at Guantanamo.
The real significance of today's ruling is what it means for the commissions going forward.
And a summer of film noir coming on cable.
There is a kind of dread in these films. These are not films that have particularly happy endings. And yet, they're compulsively easy to watch.
But first, these news headlines.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A female prison worker has now been arrested and faces charges she helped two convicted murderers escape from a maximum security facility in upstate New York. The pair apparently used power tools to cut their way out of the Clinton Correctional Facility. Clinton County District Attorney Andrew Wiley says while the woman, Joyce Mitchell, does not appear to have supplied the tools, she does face other felony charges in the case.
The promoting prison contraband charge is a Class D felony. The minimum sentence and maximum sentence range on those is a 1 1/3 to 4 or a 2 1/3 to 7 year maximum sentence. And the facilitation charge is the facilitation to commit the escape is a Class A misdemeanor. Punishable up to 1 year in the local county jail.
Meanwhile, the two inmates, David Sweat and Richard Matt, are the object of an intense manhunt involving upwards of 800 federal, state, and local law enforcement officials. Parents were apparently able to break out of the prison last weekend. Investigators have discovered what appears to be another case of computer hackers penetrating the government's personnel records. NPR's Scott Horsley reports these hackers probably gained access to far-reaching information from background checks.
According to a senior administration official, investigators discovered the likelihood that information from background checks was stolen while looking into a separate hacking attack on the government's Office of Personnel Management. Investigators say they're still trying to determine how many background checks might have been compromised, but because those checks often contain information about would-be workers' families and others, the effects could be far-reaching. The government's chief information officer has directed all federal agencies to check for evidence of cyber attacks, patch known vulnerabilities, and where possible, limit access to sensitive files within the next 30 days. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
The Obama administration is distributing more than $100 million in aid money to drought-stricken western states. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports a large share of the funds are going to California farm country.
This relief package includes roughly $18 million for a new federal program that will temporarily employ farm workers and others during this drought. Assistant Secretary of Labor Portia Wu says work will be available doing restoration and drought mitigation in hard-hit communities.
These grants can provide much-needed assistance to help get those who have lost jobs as a result of drought back to work and making them readier to handle any future drought-related crises.
This is the